schedule. And we're ready to hear argument in Seaford Golf versus DuPont. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Hackett?
Yes, sir.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is David Hackett. I'm the attorney for the appellant, the Seaford Golf and Country Club, which, if it's acceptable, I'll refer to as a country club throughout the proceedings. This case came from the Superior Court. The country club had filed a motion, or had filed a complaint for declaratory judgment, primarily asking the court to interpret the term plant as used in a restrictive covenant and a right of first refusal in a deed and a ground lease, respectively, that was granted to the country club by DuPont. What brought us to the court was that DuPont in 2004 sold its plant to an organization known as Artiva. And Artiva but retained ownership in the land on which the plant sat. Now, the restrictive covenants indicated that once DuPont no longer owned the Seaford, Delaware plant, then that restriction would terminate. A similar provision was contained in the right of first refusal. So upon the sale of the plant, not the land, without the land, to Artiva, the country club believed that both the restriction and the right of first refusal were terminated. The country club contracted to sell a part of the country club land to a third party. Now, once DuPont heard of this, they said, no, the restricted covenant had not terminated. We didn't sell the land. Therefore, we didn't sell all of the plant, so it's still in effect. We ended up in court for the declaratory judgment. both parties filed motions for summary judgment. The motion of the country club was denied, and the motion of DuPont was granted.
Before you go any further, I gather the issue basically is whether the term plant is used in those two instruments does or does not include the underlying land.
Exactly. And that's the primary issue.
Okay. And then secondarily, whether that issue can be decided on a summary judgment record. My question is, what discovery was taken in connection with the summary judgment motion? What kind of record do we have here?
We have a record showing documents that were passed back and forth during negotiations of the agreements. Then after the agreements were signed, we have, I'm trying to remember what we do have in the record.
But do we have deposition testimony?
No deposition testimony.
Interrogatory answers? Affidavit?
I have to try and remember. I know we requested a number of documents.
Do we have affidavits?
Yes.
Does it verify or authenticate the documents? Or are they speaking affidavits?
Speaking affidavits. Yes. We did get the documents relating to the transfer of the plant facility to Artiva back in 2004. Because the parties agreed that the term was not ambiguous and it wasn't necessary to really put on the record extrinsic evidence to show intent.
Is there affidavit testimony by the representatives of the parties who negotiated the agreements that contained the covenant and the right of first refusal?
No.
I guess following up on those questions, you're obviously
seeking relief from the trial court's decision. Are you asking that this go back for a more fully developed record and to allow the court to have a basis to reach an opposite conclusion, or are you saying that just as a matter of law, the interpretation that the Superior Court gave to this language was wrong and it unambiguously means the opposite?
My position is the latter.
So you're not asking the court to basically get more information before reaching a decision. You're saying that this is simply a matter of pick a definition. It's either this or it's that, and we say that the trial court picked the wrong one.
That's basically it. What the trial court did, you know, we have the Lorillard case, which says that when the court's asked to interpret a term that's not defined in a contract, then the courts will look to dictionary definitions to define that term. The lower court, we had presented a number of dictionary definitions to the lower court. The lower court rejected those definitions and formulated its own principle interpretation, so to speak. What the court said was that...
But isn't the problem that, you know, you can come out one way or the opposite depending on which dictionary definition you pick? I mean, we don't have a situation here where all the dictionary definitions that are available go one way.
Well, I think we do.
Well, that's because you're parsing out the dictionary definitions, aren't you? You're creating a distinction between manufacturing plant and some other kind of plant.
And well, that's part of it, but if you look at the definitions that were offered by the parties, there's only one definition that includes land, specifically includes land in the definition. And
so is it a matter of counting the number of dictionary definitions that go one way?
No, I don't think that's the case. If you look at the definition where land is included, it's included. It doesn't say that a plant includes land, factory, buildings, equipment. It says a plant is land, factory, buildings, and equipment employed in a trade or industrial business. So the way I read that is that the land actually has to be part of the process. It has to be actually employed or utilized, or the products of the land have to be utilized.
Why isn't this a situation where the term, although superficially, would appear to be unambiguous because it seems like a fairly common term, on the other hand, is susceptible of two interpretations, both of which are reasonable, and that therefore this is ambiguous language and that the court should get assistance, if you will, in the form of extrinsic evidence, in the form of deposition testimony and other factual development as to what the parties actually intended?
Well, I can tell you how the U.S. Supreme Court handled that issue. In the case of MCI Telecommunications Corporation versus AT&T, which is 512 U.S. 218. In that case, the petitioner was had cited a dictionary definition to the court. It was the only dictionary definition of the term modify, which said that modification is an extensive change. It's the only dictionary definition out there that said that. Just like here, the only dictionary definition out there is Webster's, which says land. All the other dictionaries that were brought before the court said that to modify is a modest change. Not an extreme change, but a modest change.
Is this case cited in your brief?
No, this is not.
What year was it decided?
This was decided in 1994.
And why wasn't it in your brief if it's the linchpin of your argument here?
Because we weren't talking about ambiguities in the brief. Justice Berger was asking, why shouldn't we declare an ambiguity here? Because we got these conflicting definitions, and I was indicating how the U.S. Supreme Court handled that. Because that's exactly what the petitioner in that case was asking the court to do, is declare an ambiguity. And the court said, well, you know, we have two complete opposite definitions. One is totally aberrant because there's no other dictionary that calls for this definition. Even in the dictionary where that definition appeared, it had alternate definitions, which were contrary. And he said, they can't mean both the same thing. So they just basically disregarded the aberrant one and went with more popular one, so to speak.
But aren't we dealing here with a slightly different situation? If you're worried about what the meaning of the term modify is, then you look to dictionary definitions, and some say it means one thing, and one says it means something totally different. Here, you've got the term plant, and you don't have a bunch of definitions that say a plant includes all the facilities except the land. A plant includes every facility but not the land, and so on and so forth. You have a bunch of definitions that say a plant includes the various buildings and doesn't really say whether it includes the land or not. So those definitions arguably are not precise enough, incomplete. It's not as if you've got, if I understand the facts here, it's not as if you've got a record of every source document on definitions of the word plant, say, not land, and one of them says land. Isn't that true?
Well, the definitions don't exclude land, but it doesn't exclude other assets that might be utilized with a plant, such as a company jet.
Well, what
I mean,
does
I don't
the
think
record,
you have. I don't think you have
excuse
to.
Me just a moment. What does the record show was really sold in this case? Was it a building, or based on what's in the record, would we see that what was sold was, you know, 100 feet of land on each side of the building? Because as I understand it, there was a sale of the plant or building, whatever we're calling it,
right,
and then a lease of the land.
That's correct.
So was any land sold or only the building?
It was only the building.
Okay.
And the processes and the intellectual property and all of the
money. Yes, everything is related. The land was retained ultimately to be conveyed to Artiva when certain environmental issues had been corrected.
So to the extent the land around the building was used for storage, parking for employees, whatever, that was leased.
That's all leased, yes.
Okay.
In fact, 11 parcels of land in various locations were leased to Artiva. You have 11 parcels of land. There's a great number of acreage. I didn't total it, but some of those parcels are not contiguous. Which brings to another problem. If the term plant is going to include land, we don't know what land is included in this case. So the court, by doing that, by including land,
why wouldn't it be the land?
Created an ambiguity.
Why wouldn't it be the land that is covered by the ground lease?
The Artiva ground lease or the Country Club ground lease?
The Artiva ground lease.
I don't know. I mean, that land includes a sizable parcel where the plant sits. That land includes the parcel that we're leasing from DuPont, and that land includes another contiguous parcel towards the east, as I recall.
Well, Mr. Harrington,
and then lots all over town.
If someone had done a title search of the land owned by DuPont before the sale of the plant, that would be something that would be ascertainable, correct? I mean, that's something that a good title searcher could discover.
Discover what land was owned by DuPont?
Yeah. I mean, that's a knowable fact.
Sure.
And if one were to then compare the land that the description of the land that was covered by the ground lease to Artiva with the land that DuPont owned before the sale, what does the record show whether that those two pieces of land would be coextensive or whether they would be different?
To my knowledge, and I haven't done a title examination with regard to this, but to my knowledge, and this is based upon the contract, which said that they were supposed to sell all the land that DuPont, or lease all the land that DuPont owned in the Seaford area. Then every parcel of land that DuPont owned there was leased.
So there wouldn't be an issue of what land would be covered if the term plant included the land, at least not in this case.
Well, I can see room for argument there. I mean, suppose DuPont conveyed the one parcel, which is a separate parcel, or a separately described parcel, where the plant located.
I don't think we need to engage in law school hypotheticals. DuPont either leased all the land that it owned or didn't.
Right.
Does the record show what the fact is?
It did. But what I'm saying is that by including land in this definition, when we don't know what land was intended, creates an ambiguity itself, because there's going to be what land was included is subject to a number of different meanings.
Well, Mr. Hackett, you have a little under 3 minutes left. Would you like to save that for rebuttal?
Yes, I didn't see that my my yellow light was on. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Dent.
Good afternoon. And may it please the court. On cross motions for summary judgment, the trial court reviewed various dictionary definitions in an attempt to ascertain the plain meaning of the word plant, as used in the phrase Seaford, Delaware plant in the relevant documents. And the court concluded that those dictionaries did not provide a uniform definition from which to ascertain the intent of the parties in conditioning the enforcement of the deed restriction and the right of first refusal upon DuPont's continued ownership of the Seaford, Delaware plant.
Mr. Dent, two questions. Is it correct that despite your disagreements with Mr. Hackett, you both agree that there's no ambiguity in these two instruments that are at issue here?
Yes, Your Honor. The parties cross-moved and both argued to the trial court that there was no ambiguity.
Okay. Second question is, DuPont sold all of the business, that is the physical plant and the hardware and means of production that were contained in the building, and I gather the intellectual property rights to all of the processes, everything except the land.
Correct.
So basically, except for being an owner of land, DuPont is no longer there. It's no longer present on the scene.
That's correct. They do not have operations at the site any longer. Those are maintained by Invista.
In those circumstances, what interest does DuPont have in seeking to enforce the covenant and the right of first refusal? That is, what legitimate interest of DuPont is served by objecting to the proposed sale of a piece of Seifert's land?
I think the answer, Your Honor, is that DuPont is still an adjacent landowner of the property. And it's probably worth pointing out that when the property was sold to the country club, there was a carve-out. There was a parcel of the property that was conveyed to the club that the club was able to develop. The rest of the material of the parcel, the property, including the parcel that the club wishes to develop here, was subject to the deed restriction, and it's physically located directly across from the entrance to the plant. DuPont's concern, and this isn't in the record, but I can represent that DuPont's concern has been that in the event that this property is developed, there's going to be a residential neighborhood, people living in that residential neighborhood might claim that there's a nuisance, and even though they've moved to that property, if in fact they were to take action to sue Invista, let's say, because of the operation of the plant, and it's not unheard of for someone to move to a nuisance and claim and then sue over that, DuPont would clearly be identified, named as a defendant in that litigation because they're the landowner. And so unless until the title changes, they continue to desire to protect themselves from that eventuality.
But that's not in the record.
It's not, Your Honor. That's correct.
What is in the record that would evidence DuPont's legitimate interest?
I think just the documents themselves, Your Honor, and Your Honor had asked earlier the question about what was discovered. All of the negotiating history. Mr. Hackett represented the country club back in the 1990s when the negotiations were going on between the club and DuPont. All of those, all the correspondence that went back and forth, and it was lengthy correspondence, in connection with both the deed and the ground lease are in the record. So, I think one of the things that the trial judge did, and I'm getting sort of with the end of its opinion, it went on, and after it determined the plain meaning from looking at this objective standard, the trial court went on to say, although I'm not assuming this word is ambiguous, if I concluded it was ambiguous, the intent of the parties, as I review these materials that the parties have provided to me, all the correspondence and things, demonstrate that DuPont always had this interest right from the outset that they would be able to maintain this restriction unless and until they divested themselves of the entirety of the property. That's in the record, but there isn't any deposition testimony. There are no affidavits. The only evidence in the record is the correspondence reflecting the negotiations.
Well, in addition to that, Judge Graves said he would look at it from the point of view of what a reasonable person would want to do, and he reached the same conclusion applying that test, didn't he?
He did, Justice Holland, and in fact that is a test that that the club argued below. At page B39 of DuPont's appendix, which is a part of the transcript from the proceedings below, Mr. Hackett said to the court, if the court agrees that this is an unambiguous term, as both parties claim, then the court has to interpret the language in the manner that a reasonable third party would interpret it. So that was the standard that the club urged the court to adopt. And it is this standard, I think, that the court adopted when it was unable to discern from the various dictionaries a plain meaning for the word plant. So what the court did was then the court looked at the language and looked at of the agreement itself and concluded that an objective third party looking at this language would have to conclude that the intent of the deed restriction and the right of first refusal or the intent of the parties when they entered into those documents was that they would be enforceable until such time as DuPont divested its entire interest.
Well, let's test that. It is the case, is it not, that one of the two agreements that's at issue here makes reference to the plant site, that is the land underneath the plant, correct?
I know the consent order does, Your Honor. The consent order that was attached to the ground lease, the ground lease was entered into in 1997, 2 years after the deed. The ground lease was attached, the terms of the consent order that had been entered into years earlier were not incorporated in the ground lease. However, it was attached, and I think it was the ground lease that refers to the plant site.
Okay, I thought that in addition to the ground lease, which was attached, there was a reference along those lines, that either directly referenced the land or the plant site. in one of the other two agreements, but I don't have a recollection of the precise language.
I don't recall that either at this point, Your Honor. Maybe Mr. Hackett and rebuttal could. I don't recall that. My recollection is that the only reference to the plant site was in the consent order, which was drafted by the EPA, was adopted by DuPont in 1992. There's nothing in the record to indicate that that was that the consent order was accepted by or that the parties negotiating over the consent order at DuPont were the same folks who were involved in the negotiation of the deed and the ground lease sometime later on. And Ms. DeLuzio just pointed out to me that the deed refers to plant operation, Your Honor, and that is referred to at page A3, appendix A3.
Okay, so we have one, the deed referring to plant operations as distinguished from plant site, and we have the EPA consent order referring to the plant site. Couldn't a reasonable person seeing those two terms conclude, or at least infer, that there is a distinction between plant and plant site or plant operations and underlying land?
I'm not so sure I can agree, Justice Jacobs, because of the context in which that language appears. The language in the reference to the plant operation is...
No one can infer it?
Well, the reference to plant operation is in relation to the discussion of the groundwater at the plant. And the quote is that the groundwater is critical to grantor's plant operation, which adjoins the property, meaning the property being referred to the club property. So I think if you take that, the plant operation is a different context. It's being used in connection with the groundwater. I think obviously reasonable minds might differ, and the two parties have argued differently as to what was intended at the time this document was entered into. And I guess that highlights the possibility, and I think Justice Berger may have been correct when she asked the question, couldn't somebody say that this language is ambiguous? The parties took the position that it was not, and certainly it's within the inherent authority of this court to conclude otherwise.
And we're simply trying to determine what the correct application of that principle is. The Superior Court found that there could be no inference other than an inference that favors DuPont as a matter of law. And the question is, what is the basis for that legal conclusion when you have language in different parts of these agreements that at least suggests that the parties recognized, by their verbal expression, the difference between the land and the plant or the plant operations?
It could be, Your Honor, that one way that the trial court got to that conclusion was that it did look at it, did review in connection with its, although it said, I don't find the term ambiguous. If I did find it ambiguous, looking at the negotiations, it's clear that this was what was intended by DuPont for it from the very beginning. And what the court did is, at the very end of its opinion, when it looked at this, it said, DuPont from the very outset said, even when they began negotiations, they said, we have to make sure that we want to be able to maintain this deed restriction. And in connection with the ground lease, the club proposed language that specifically, when they were trying to interpret the word plant, they proposed language that said that it covered everything, that it covered the land. And Mr. Hackett even agreed.
Sorry, is that right? Or didn't they just simply use the words total divestiture?
Well, in the argument below, Your Honor, when the court asked the question, Mr. Hackett said that specifically in reference to the ground lease, when the club proposed language to DuPont, he said, and I quote, and this is appears at page B33, DuPont's appendix. He said the definitions that we were proposing did include the land. That's what he told the trial court, and so the trial court understood from the representations of the club's counsel that when the ground lease was being negotiated, the club proposed language that specifically said it covers the land.
And what was that language?
I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor. It's in the record.
Two questions. What was that language? And then the next question is, did that language end up in the ultimate agreement?
It did not. The language remained as the same. No, ultimately, the parties did not agree on language. But what the trial
could not could not a reasonable person draw an inference from those facts that DuPont believed that you know DuPont had a different concept of what plant would or would not include. That is, that it would not include the land.
I think yes. I think a reasonable person could conclude that. But what the trial court concluded, and I think this is the more reasonable interpretation, when the trial court looked at it and said, well, from the very outset, DuPont was saying years earlier, 1995, we have to have a deed restriction that we can enforce. It's going to cover everything. And then we've got the word plant. And now the club is proposing language in the ground lease that covers the land. The trial judge said it would be unreasonable in that circumstance to assume that DuPont then would have intended to have something to accept something less than they had asked for at the very beginning, and in fact something less than the club was offering in the language that they were proposing in connection with the ground lease. So I think reasonable minds can differ, but I think the trial court was right when the trial court reviewed the entirety of the record, and the trial court concluded that it really wasn't reasonable to assume that DuPont would have accepted something less than it had asked for right from the very outset. It is unfortunate that the parties didn't redefine or define the word plant in 1997 when the ground lease was being negotiated, but they didn't. And it's clear that the club, at least at that time, was proposing language that suggested that it believed land was covered. And then DuPont, there's nothing in the record to suggest that DuPont said, no thanks, we don't want it to be covered that broadly. We only want to cover the building, the facilities. We didn't mean to include the land.
I understand that, but is there anything in the record that shows clearly that DuPont did intend to exclude land from the term plant?
No, Your Honor. I would submit that the documents themselves indicate that DuPont intended to include the land, but there's nothing in the record that speaks other than the correspondence and the language of the documents themselves. There's nothing in the record that specifically addresses that issue. There's nothing in the record that, other than the documents themselves, that from which we can draw the conclusion that DuPont intended from the outset.
There's no correspondence where DuPont takes that position?
Just in the very beginning, before they began negotiating, there's correspondence from DuPont saying that they would want to be able to maintain the deed restriction. And remember, now we're only talking about the original parcel, the original, I guess it was the front nine or the back nine, one of the half of the course, because half of the course was sold in 1995, and the other half was leased. And in well in advance of the deed that conveyed the portion that was sold to the club in 1995, at the very outset, there is correspondence, and this is in the record. It was before the trial court that DuPont was saying, "We're happy to enter into negotiations, but we have to be able to restrict the use of this country club property to country club use as long as we own the facility." And it was understood, at least from our perspective, that when the parties then negotiated, that was the overriding concern of DuPont. And Your Honor had asked the question at the outset, is there anything in the record to indicate what, in fact, DuPont's concern was? And the answer is no, but we would argue that we can be inferred from the fact that they were the landowner, they were operating the facility, and they carved out a parcel of land from this deed restriction that would have allowed the club to build a residential neighborhood on approximately 4 acres of land on a different portion of the property, but the deed restriction would preclude the residential development on the property that's contiguous to the property line where the facility operates.
Well, I understand that one can draw a reasonable person can draw an inference that favors that interpretation. Your argument, though, is that the inference that the court drew was the more reasonable interpretation. That's not a proper argument for summary judgment, though, is it?
Well, I think we do believe it is the more reasonable interpretation. We also believe
the standard the only reasonable interpretation.
I submit that it is the only reasonable interpretation, Your Honor. And I say that because, again, the parties, because of the context, the parties had cross moved, and under Rule 56H, if parties cross moved, the parties are representing that there is no material issue of fact. No material issue of fact was argued, and so that left it to the court below to rule on the record. And I submit that the really the only logical conclusion from reviewing the entirety of the record is that DuPont always desired to maintain that deed restriction as long as it owned the property. It still does own the property, as Mr. Hackett has conceded. There will likely come a time when this property will be conveyed to Invista. That time has not yet occurred. If and when that happens, then DuPont waives its deed restriction. It no longer applies, and we won't be here. But unless and until then, again, we submit that the only reasonable interpretation is that DuPont intended to maintain that deed restriction.
I'm curious. I understand that the parties made cross motions and represented that there were no material issues of fact in dispute, and that both parties felt that this term is unambiguous. What would happen, or what would have happened, if the trial court took a look at all of this and wrote a decision saying, well, notwithstanding what both parties are telling me, I find this to be ambiguous, and I'm not going to go any further yet? Would you put on more evidence?
I think the parties would be, yes. I think the short answer, Justice Berger, is yes. I think the parties would at that point conduct the depositions. In fact, Mr. Hackett and I, before we got to the part where we were discussing motions, we on a discussion outside of the courthouse when we were in Georgetown the first time to discuss scheduling, we talked about what discovery, whether or not there might be depositions. And I think it's not in the record, but I think we agreed that there wouldn't be any depositions unless and until the court denied both summary judgment motions. At that point, I think the parties would, I'm sure, conduct deposition discovery. I don't know whether or not the folks at DuPont who were involved in negotiations are still with DuPont. I'd have to find that out. I know Mr. Hackett was involved.
But basically what you're saying is that you wouldn't be content to simply rely on what's in the record now if the court were looking at it from the standpoint of, this is ambiguous, I'm going to have to ascertain from extrinsic evidence what the proper interpretation is. You would want to include more evidence for the court's consideration.
I guess from DuPont's perspective, we don't believe that additional that there would be a requirement. I think we believe that the court could go on and do what the trial court did, which was review the entirety of the record and sort of reach the same conclusion.
But what I'm saying is, would you want the opportunity to present more evidence, or would you say, fine, if you're going to look at it from the standpoint that this is ambiguous, the record is as complete as we care to make it?
Your Honor, I believe that our position would be the latter. But obviously I can't speak for Mr. Hackett.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask it another way. The Court of Chancery has a rule that said if the parties submit cross motions for summary judgment, unless one of the parties notifies the courts to the contrary, and you have stipulated that you've submitted the case for a decision based on this paper record. So as I understood your answer to Justice Berger's question, you're content with that position in this case, although there was never a formal stipulation.
Justice Holland, I believe that's correct, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hackett, you have 2.5 minutes. Before you start, is that your position also, that you're stipulating that the Superior Court and our court can decide this case based on the record that's presented?
As far as if it's determined that the term is ambiguous?
Right.
I would think so. I think it's more of an issue for DuPont, because if you look at the record.
Well, they've already agreed. The
right.
Question is, do you agree that we can decide this case based on the record we have?
I don't think you can, because I don't think there's right. anything in this record that shows what DuPont intended.
Well, now, I'm asking you a different question. I just said, in the Court of Chancery, on cross motions for summary judgment, unless a party indicates to the contrary, there is a stipulation that the case will be decided on the paper record presented.
That's correct.
And based on both of your arguments, you're conveying the impression to this court that that's what you agree, that the Superior Court could decide the case based on the paper record presented. My question is that your position today before this court? are you and Mr. Dent, Mr. Dent has agreed, he stipulates, do you stipulate, and that we can decide the case based on the paper record the two of you have presented?
Yes.
Okay. But you can continue with your...
All right. Just to make sure we're clear on this.
I'm not clear.
All right. What we're driving at is this. Both parties said to the trial court, this is what the term means, and it's unambiguous, and here's why we're right. Okay?
Correct.
And there was a certain amount of documentary evidence that was before the trial court, correspondence, what have you, right? If this court were to say that even though you both thought this was unambiguous, in context, under these circumstances, we conclude that this term is reasonably susceptible of two interpretations and is ambiguous, at which point the final determination of what the term means would be made in part by reference to extrinsic evidence. The question for you is, if we said this is ambiguous and sent it back to the trial court, would you now want to put in more evidence than is already part of the record, because now the court is going to make its decision based upon extrinsic evidence? Or would you say, that's fine, you've got all the information you need in the way of extrinsic evidence, we don't want to put on any more evidence?
That's the position I would take.
Fine. Okay.
The question was, were there any other places where in the documents where the plant property was referenced? And there was a place in the ground lease which read...
Where is that in the appendix? What page are you?
A25.
Okay.
DuPont Seaford plant property, and then in parentheses, the, quote, site, unquote, in parentheses. So I think that was probably the place you had recalled or were referring to. So that would be in addition to the reference in the stipulated order. With regard to the concerns of DuPont about possible lawsuits, I think that's certainly speculation. We don't know whether there ever will be any lawsuits, but you have to recognize that we're just asking for to be able to extend an existing use of the property. As DuPont has already pointed out, there was a section that was excluded from this restriction, and that is residential. In fact, there are houses built there now, and we're just extending the use to another part of the property. But getting back to the court's decision, the court said that a reasonable person would view the plant as being a place, and a place includes land. Now, I submit that reasonable people could disagree. It's not unreasonable to think that a person would say, yes, the plant.
Your time is up. The court appreciates both of your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement, and we'll take a brief recess for the change of the panel.
Please rise.